This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Happy Monday. We are going to start the show talking about the latest reopening measures, which go into effect today across the Commonwealth. Indoor performance spaces, recreation centers can now open at 50% capacity. Restaurants no longer have a capacity limit, although they must enforce social distancing, but they're now also allowed to offer live music performances. Now, some communities, City of Boston, Somerville, are holding back on some of these measures for at least a few weeks because the fact is some see the state's loosening of restrictions as foolish and premature, even while others see it as much needed relief. Here is what Governor Baker had to say while addressing the media at a vaccine clinic at Morningstar Baptist Church in Mattapan this morning.
It doesn't mean, however, that people can or should let down their guard. Everybody knows what it takes. Wearing masks, socially distancing, washing your hands, not participating in a lot of informal gatherings with people who aren't part of your home, household bubble, and understanding and recognizing the caution remains the watchword here.
So everyone's looking at the same data. So is this a good idea or not? We are going to hear some pros and cons, and we welcome your perspective. Do you support the loosening this week? Are you ready to go to places like restaurants without capacity limits? Laser tag. Are you a business owner preparing to reopen to more customers? Maybe you think it's too soon and you want everybody to hold back a while longer. And what about these plans to open further? Phase 4 for the first time is on the docket beginning March 22nd. Call us 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So let us begin by speaking with a medical professional. Dr. Davidson Hamer is a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, professor at Boston University School of Public Health. Dr. Hamer, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you joining us and our listeners. I want to start straight up. Do you think this next step in reopening today is appropriate, or do you think it comes too soon?
Well, I've been thinking about this over the last few days, and I was a little hesitant about this, and I still am. I think that a lot of our indicators are improving. The sort of case numbers are down, the proportion positive are down, I think hospitalizations are down. I mean, a lot of good indicators. Even the wastewater data look better, although they had a little bit of a blip and a rise last week, but that seems to flatten out. So, I mean, all the indicators are that transmission is slowing. But on the flip side, you know, there's growing evidence as we're starting to sequence more virus that some of the variants of concern, including the UK strain, are circulating. And that could change the balance towards more transmission.
So let's talk specifically about, you referred to them as the variants of concern and the fact that they're circulating now in the Commonwealth. How and why would that be a game changer in this sort of calculus about how to reopen?
Well, the one that's been identified most commonly so far is called B117. This is also known as the UK variant. And this one is of concern because of evidence that it may be more transmissible, that may be more spread more easily from person to person than the sort of standard strain that we have had in the U.S. And there's some evidence, actually one small study suggesting that people that are infected with it shed the virus for a longer period of time than people with a more standard strain, which means they could be infectious for a longer period of time. And you know, because that's starting to spread, and there's concern that that may become the dominant strain in Massachusetts and in parts of the U.S. where it's spreading. That could tip things in the other direction towards almost a resurgence, like a fourth wave for parts of the U.S. or a third wave for Massachusetts. So, you know, I think because of that, you know, I'm concerned that could exacerbate the situation just when things are looking good.
Let me just throw the number out there to our listeners, 800-423-8255, to reflect on your reactions to the fact that we are entering phase 3, step 2 again today, loosening, doing more reopening. Dr. Hamer, I do just want to ask you, you said the UK variant might shed for a longer period. Just briefly, how much longer?
Oh, this is very preliminary data, and it's a small number of patients, so I'm not sure I would put a lot of weight on it yet, but we clearly need more evidence. But at least one description I read was, or actually heard from a colleague, an epidemiologist in Connecticut, that it was shedding as much as 5 or 6 days longer on average than the standard strain.
That's a lot. Okay.
That is a lot.
So I want to bring in a couple of national voices here. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, formerly Massachusetts General Hospital. She was asked specifically about the governor's newest rules for restaurants last Friday. The governor's announcement was Thursday afternoon. She was asked last Friday. She said her agency, quote, would really encourage people in states to not expand and release restrictions, end quote. Then today, she appeared to double down. According to a Boston Globe report, she feels that the infection rate is kind of plateauing at a daily number that's too high, and she said she's, quote, really worried, end quote, about states backing off on what she called the exact public health measures that the CDC recommends. And I want to play one other, because then Dr. Anthony Fauci doubled down yesterday on CNN in relation to Rochelle Walensky's comments. Here he is talking to Dana Bash.
Are the easing of those restrictions?
Yeah, I would think it is. I think, you know, obviously each individual state and city needs to look at the situation in their own location where they are. But in general, to think just because the cases are coming down on a daily basis, take a look at the pattern. And just watch over the next several days to a week. If we do this and start coming up, then we're going to go right back to the road of rebounding. So that's the reason why I agree completely with what Dr. Walensky has said.
Does that mean that Governor Baker is basically flat out disregarding the advice of public health experts by moving to this phase now?
That's a question for me. I mean, I think... You know, Governor Baker actually in his press conference this morning, which is more about vaccines, but he did say, you know, they're trying to balance, you know, sort of, you know, the need to reopen the economy with what they think is safe. And you know, again, as he noted, you know, a lot of the indicators for Massachusetts are looking up or really going down, and therefore they feel comfortable opening. But at the same time, you have, you know, two major public health authorities, Dr. Walensky and Dr. Fauci, saying, whoa, let's slow down. And I'm in agreement with them. I think we you know, if we gave things 2 to 4 more weeks at least before making this move, and had further decline, lower case rate, less evidence of transmission in the community, that would be a safer situation to consider expansion of restaurant dining and so forth.
1-800-423-8255 to tell us what you think of where we are in the reopening and the newest steps to relax that reopening a little bit more. We've got Laura on the line from Jamaica Plain. Laura, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Governor Baker says that restaurants have no capacity. You know, you can sit in a restaurant 6 feet apart with masks off indoors when this is an airborne virus that floats in the air. Yet, he doesn't want us to blend families. Like, you're not supposed to blend households. That's blending households indoors.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that call, Laura. No, let's pick that back up there, Laura. And Dr. Hamer, I do want to talk about the difference between what we're allowing in public spaces, what we're allowing in private spaces, and where you see the source of the risk being the greatest.
That's a tough question. I mean, I think, you know, there's evidence for both transmission in public places, you know, in particular dining establishments like restaurants and bars, you know, places where, you know, people may only be 6 feet apart, which may be not sufficient distance, but they're taking their masks off and they're off for extended periods of time because they're eating or drinking. I mean, that is very similar to a home situation. If you have a group of people in your home, you know, often you're going to be eating or drinking and socializing and, you know, masked down. And if it's your immediate family and you've been with them for weeks, you know their status. But if you're inviting friends or relatives in that may have had other contacts that you are not aware of, the risk is high. And I think that Laura's point is really appropriate, that, you know, the risk of having, you know, a group of people in your home is very similar to having a group of people in a restaurant eating at the next table. I mean, 6 feet is not enough to completely prevent spread of this disease. Certainly 6 feet or more and masks, you're in a good place. But you know, again, in a restaurant, you can't keep masks on most of a lot of the time.
So I want to ask you a counterpoint question here. According to the State House News Service, we've reached the point in the Commonwealth where the number of people who've been fully vaccinated is roughly equal to the number of people who have had COVID-19 over the last year. And we also know that there are these range of estimates out there of what percentage of the population is likely to have had the virus without knowing it. So sort of the total percent of the population that may have some immunity because they've had the virus. And credible sources, you know, you see estimates that range anywhere from 40% to 55%. When one hears that data, does it change how we should look at and consider this reopening and the needs of business owners and people for socialization and community, et cetera? Where does that fit in?
I mean, I think that having a good reading, like a fairly accurate estimate of people who have had the disease, especially in the last 3 to 6 months, because there's some evidence that immunity may wane, may fade away with time, especially for people who had a milder infection. But knowing, you know, what proportion have had the disease, what proportion have had the vaccine, and then, you know, sort of seeing where we are in relation to the estimates, which is as high as 70 to 80% of what you need to reach to develop herd immunity. I mean, we will really know that we've gotten there when transmission drops down to very low levels and then starts to fizzle out altogether. And I don't think we're anywhere near that level yet.
I'd like to grab just a couple more caller voices here. We've got Dave on the line from West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. My only question on this is, what's the goal now? We've had a lot of goals. We seem to have obtained them. You know, the first one is, of course, flatten the curve, save the hospitals, keep people from dying. It seems like those things were the vaccines are going to really help with. So what's our goal here? Is it to become herd immunity before we open up the rest of the economy? Or are we going to be able to live with this virus until everyone can get vaccinated or boosters or whatever they need to get for that to happen? I mean, how long do people expect us to keep us locked down like that?
Thanks, Dave. I'm going to add one more voice here, Kara in Worcester, and then I'll come back to you, Dr. Hamer. Kara, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, we keep hearing reopen the economy, but we've never really closed the economy. The restrictions we've put in place seem really, not anywhere near severe as some other countries, and we're still right now at about 10 times the level we were when we even put the kind of moderate restrictions we did in place a year ago. And I just think we don't have to choose between people's livelihoods and their lives. If we had some courage to tax the Massachusetts billionaires that have, you know, each gotten about $1 billion richer this year.
I appreciate that, Kara. I just don't want to get into tax policy here, especially with Dr. Hamer. And I would say we did have some fairly significant restrictions, especially a year ago this month. I mean, it was pretty hardcore. So I do want to put that in a piece of perspective as well. So a couple last comments there. Last thoughts and reaction from you, Dr. Hamer.
Sure. I mean, both Dave and Kara, you know, raise interesting points. And you know, the goal now, you know, I think really is, I mean, the ultimate goal is to...
Oh, we may have lost Dr. Hamer there, and that's a bit of a... There you go.
I don't know. Somehow
I was muted
by the system. That was a Zoom snag there.
It gave us a cliffhanger, so go ahead.
So anyways, what I was saying is that, you know, I think right now the ultimate goal is really to get transmission down to very low levels. We still want to try and help, you know, the most vulnerable of our society to get vaccination, but also to be protected if they've not yet received the vaccine. Yeah. And you know, there is a sort of delicate balance with further reopening of the economy, because, you know, Kara's right. I mean, we already are open. It's just a matter of opening more. I think ultimately we still want to try and reduce severe disease, hospitalization, and death. By widely distributing the vaccine, but also by continuing to have some, you know, measures in effect that prevent transmission in public places, we'll be able to get there.
All right. That is Dr. Davidson Hamer, professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine and a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. My pleasure. Thank you.
So we're gonna welcome a couple of restaurant owners now. We want to get your sense of, when will you go back to a restaurant? How anxious are you to do that? When your local pub reopens, will you go? What businesses, what local restaurants, eateries, taverns are you missing the most? Give them a shout out. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us is Tim Athanasiades. I hope I get that right, Tim. He is the owner of Asperia Grill in Brighton. Tim, we've talked with you a few times throughout the pandemic. And just quickly, also, Royal Smith is proprietor of District 7 Tavern in Roxbury and a founding member of the Boston Black Hospitality Coalition. Tim, Royal, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me back.
Definitely. Thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you. So, Tim, I'm going to start with you. You have been open throughout, including serving a lot of takeout early on. Will any of the changes today affect you and how?
Actually, there's no changes whatsoever. I got all excited when I heard 100%, but then the 6 feet apart just brought us right back where we were. It's going to stay strictly takeout because 11 chairs, my capacity is 44, so 11 chairs doesn't do anything. So we're actually, I'm kind of glad the governor's going in the right direction, hopefully the same, we will be at 100%, but it doesn't change anything in my establishment.
So Tim, should we take away from that then, that if you're a smaller establishment, until some of the social distancing guidelines are reduced, et cetera, you just can't get the capacity in that you need to have it make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, for larger venues, I think, and I certainly hope that this helps them. But if you have the space for the 6 feet apart, you know, great. Take advantage of it. I'm glad it's happening. But for places like mine, it just doesn't work.
Royal, I'm going to bring you in. You've been closed as a tavern. You don't reopen today. You can't until phase four. But the Commonwealth says that unless public health markers shift, that can happen on March 22nd. Are you getting ready? Are you going to reopen on the 22nd?
I'm going to reopen whenever it's safe for my community, and I have the ability to open.
And what does that mean for you?
You know, unless there's a major intention, like a intentional influx of resources and cash for Black-owned businesses like myself, we're not going to survive. We're not going to make it. And then we're going to go into the whole thing of starting off on an uneven playing field as we were prior to the pandemic.
Royal, that's really serious. Are you saying you're concerned that you can't make it to reopening and may not be able to reopen your business?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. You know, I went through the everything that, you know, has been instructed to me and the resources that have been, you know, afforded to me. But the reality is that I have not seen any fruit from those trees. And, you know, after the state of the emergency, you know, that's when, you know, real knocks on the door come from, you know, past bills that have been, you know, just piling up for the past year since I closed.
So, Tim, have you been able to access any of the federal or state programs for restaurants or small businesses?
Yes, they actually helped us out with the payroll, which is great because we were able to, you know, when this first started, we were at about a 70% nosedive, you know what I'm saying? And not just me, I believe everybody. We're still about 30-35% off because there's no dining in. And then, you know, you have great weeks and then you have really bad weeks. But thank God they did step in. They did give us some assistance. And today, every little bit helps. And I'm
grateful. So, Tim, you're referring to the payroll protection program there, right?
I am, the PPP, I am.
Royal, did you try to access PPP funds?
Several times. There were several through my bank, through, you know, different merchant accounts. But, you know, unfortunately, I was not able to get any resources from them. And, you know, just looking at the people in my circle and in the groups that I, you know, all the other business owners, it's been very scarce to people in the coalition and, you know, restaurant businesses in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan area.
And when you say the coalition, you mean the Boston Black Hospitality Coalition, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So we hear, I mean, this is such an interesting and painful moment, right? Here are these two businesses, both of you. Tim, we've been rooting for you and talking with you since the beginning of this pandemic. Royal, you are new to us and telling us a painful story of not being able to access the same resources as Tim. How much are your businesses at the mercy of whether or not you can get financial support other than in these limited well, for you, Royal, you can't sell anything. Tim, for you, it's just takeout. Help us understand just how bleeding edge that is for the two of you. And I don't mean that voyeuristically. I want people to understand what you're going through. Tim.
I went to California. I had lost a friend last week, and I was able to see that some of their cities and their major arteries, like Newbury Street, shut completely down. And what they've done is they let all the businesses occupy the street with tables, chairs. They have to become innovative here and let the people do what they need to do to survive so they don't have to close their doors. And I'm not saying shut down Newbury Street, but, our neighborhoods have side streets and so forth that maybe that approach needs to come here. Now, granted, the weather's different out there, but, we are in March, maybe a few tents, maybe a few heaters, but it is extremely difficult. I mean, I'm grateful that we're open, but it's not easy, let me tell you. You got to be on top of it 100%. And not only if the government doesn't give you anything, prices, shopping for the restaurants, we have seen an increase. We have, things are not available as much as they used to be. And the prices are a little bit higher, in some cases a lot higher. So it makes it even more difficult for us to keep the doors open.
Tim, can you give us an example of a good that is more expensive now?
Oh, absolutely. Something as simple as gloves for food, They used to be $35, $40. If you find them now, they're $99 to $106 a case versus the $40 a case. And we go through gloves, and I'm sure everybody goes through gloves there's no tomorrow. But that's just one little example of, the price of goods skyrocketing. And also the vegetables, too. From what we hear is the farms don't have the pickers to pick them, and they're being wasted and thrown away. So that raises the prices because, there's no abundance of them.
And Tim, by the way, I'm sorry to hear about the loss of your friend, too.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Royal, let me turn to you. What do you need, and what do you want people to understand right now?
What do I need? I need a lifeline, access to or the resources to not only for my business to survive, but for everybody's business to survive. COVID-19 is affecting everybody, and some more than others. I watch the same articles. Watch the same interviews and articles that everybody else does. And I see this minority funds and things going across, but it's kind of weird that I'm on the ground. None of the people around me are expressing the same, gratitude that Tim is having because we're not getting these resources. Maybe we don't know how, I would love to open. I would love to have supply-demand problems. And, District 7 Tavern is a smaller establishment. We're 827 square feet in the heart of Roxbury on Warren and Martin Luther King. And, we don't have access to sidewalks to build these outdoor venues. So, we have to get creative, which we have done. But that was last summer. We're going into a new season now, and if I don't have the money to, or the assistance or the resources to pay back rent or bills, I can't think about a reopening, and that goes for a lot of businesses in my circumstance.
So I'm noting, Royal, with you talking about the lack of access to sidewalks, Tim, with you noting that when you were in California, you saw better use of outdoor space to help restaurants and other businesses survive. Mayor Walsh did announce today that the city's bringing back the outdoor dining program on April 1st. It's expanding outdoor dining and modeling it after last year's program. Tim, will that clearly, it's Royal saying that even that won't help me. Tim, will you take advantage of that, and will that allow you to do tables, or will you still be at just takeout?
We're going to stay just takeout because of the availability of, like he just mentioned, you know, there's no sidewalks or wide enough or safe enough, and if they shut the streets down, we're going to stay takeout as long as we can, and hopefully they will allow us 50-75% dining in. Then we would seriously consider, because I'll tell you right now, customers, we're grateful because customers who did dine in are taken out from us. And all we hear, the number one question is, when are you going to reopen? When are you going to reopen? And I just keep saying, as soon as it's safe and as soon as they allow us. Going back to, I don't understand why funds are made to certain people and funds that are made to other people. Perhaps a phone call to the governor's office, or if there's some kind of office, so they can help the gentleman with the pub, you know, and say, hey, wait a minute, you know what? What can we do to provide something for you? I don't understand that. Why isn't something being done for him and in his establishment?
So I feel like, Tim and Royal, we're going to wrap up here. Tim, in making that comment, I feel like you're underscoring the differences that we have seen, and that data has played out here in the Commonwealth throughout this pandemic. The racial disparities that we've seen and the way it's impacted people, public health-wise, business-wise, and relief-wise. It's a lot for the two of you to join us, to share your stories, tell us what your situation is. I'm grateful to you both. Tim Athanasiades is the owner of Asperia Grill in Brighton. Royal Smith is proprietor of District 7 Tavern in Roxbury and a founding member of the Boston Black Hospitality Coalition. We will be thinking about both of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me as well. Thank you.
Best of luck to you. The Massachusetts congressional delegation, it's been vocal on a number of progressive issues that are key to the new Biden administration. One of those has been raising the minimum wage. Now, that provision had been in the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. The House passed the bill on Saturday. The minimum wage increase is in it. All nine representatives from Massachusetts in the House supported it, and Senators Warren and Markey do too. But now it looks like the minimum wage increase won't survive on the Senate side. Now, despite the fact that Democrats have the White House, the House, the Senate, thin margins, and Republican strategy could stymie all kinds of policy measures that are really important to Massachusetts's congresspeople and senators, what does that mean for a progressive agenda? What does it mean for your representation in Washington? Joining us now to help that comb that out a little bit is former 10-term Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. He is also now the public affairs director for the law firm Foley & Lardner. Congressman, it's been a while. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be with you, Jizzy. I'm sorry I'm not in studio.
Me too. I look forward to the day that you will be again. Let me just start by the kind of the meta question. We know who's officially in charge in Washington, but who in your mind is running the table on the policy agenda in Washington right now?
Probably right now is the moderate to, I guess, conservative, depending on your view, Democrats, because of the majority is such a thin majority. We have to please everyone. So for the sake of discussion, the bill you were just talking about, the big COVID relief bill, if they want to take a few things out that a handful of Democrats don't like for whatever reasons, they'll have to do it, because without those votes, they can't pass the bill. And it would leave the more progressive Democrats in position of having nothing. And so, honestly, it is the art of the possible in politics. And I hope they accept it. It's not something I like, but it's necessary to make progress.
Are we in a Congress where even within one party, in this case, the Democratic Party, we can see that kind of compromise to advance a policy agenda, do you think?
I hope so, if you want the truth. Otherwise, there's no progress at all. If everybody just sticks to their own personal guns, their own personal philosophy, there's never any progress, because you're never going to have a majority of people that see everything the same way. That includes both parties are big, broad parties. I think the Democratic Party is broader, but the Republican Party is broad as well. They have people like Charlie Baker and people like Ted Cruz all calling themselves Republicans. That's a pretty wide disparity as far as I'm concerned. I think you're always in it. The only question ever is how much are you willing to compromise to make progress?
So, Congressman, we have 2 years where we know that the White House, the House, and the Senate is in one party control, in this case, Democratic control. We have a progressive and Democratic slate of representatives and senators here in the Commonwealth. Do you see a runway for the issues most important for voters in the Commonwealth in Washington over the next couple of years?
Absolutely, yes. If someone wants to be an absolutist, the answer will be no. But that answer is always going to be no. But for anybody who's reasonable, in my opinion, and willing to make compromise, the answer is absolutely yes. The Massachusetts delegation is in a great position. I'm not sure they've ever been in a better position to take advantage of the current situation. So therefore, yeah, I think so. We're not going to get everything that we might like here in Massachusetts, but we're going to get a lot, as far as I'm concerned, and starting with this big COVID relief bill. A lot of what's in there is what a lot of people in Massachusetts want to see, and it won't be everything, but it was never going to be everything, and it was never going to please everybody. So that's a false measure to me.
I'm really struck by the fact that you said you're not sure that the Massachusetts congressional delegation has ever been in a better position to take advantage of sort of the policy agenda in the moment. Can you talk some more about that? You're a 10-term congressperson. You've seen a lot of different people come and go. Why do you say that?
Well, we've got Richie Neal, the chairman of Ways and Means, which is the most powerful committee in the House. Jim McGovern, the chairman of the Rules Committee, an incredibly powerful position. We have Catherine Clark in the leadership, number four in leadership. And we've got Stevie Lynch, who's got great seniority on several important committees, transportation, financial services. You've got other members, Billy Keating. These people have been great. Laurie Trahan has already moved to the Energy and Commerce Committee. We just have a very strong delegation at the moment. That might be able to take advantage of the situation. In the Senate, you've got Ed Markey with 1,000 years of experience. He knows better than anybody how to work Washington. And you've got Elizabeth Warren, who has a strong national voice. And even if they don't want to listen to her, I think they'll have to. You cannot ignore her. All that being said, I just think that if we play it right, Massachusetts can number one, influence national and international policy. Number two, do very well by Massachusetts. But again, if people forget that politics also has its own rules, and they think that somehow this is a game of tiddlywinks, and righteousness is the only thing that matters, that doesn't exist anywhere in the world that I know of, and it won't work well in Washington. You have to be willing to compromise. That doesn't mean you don't admit to it. I actually think it's the right adult, mature thing to do to say, look, I wanted this, couldn't get it. So I took 80% of this. And again, I know fully well that some people won't like that, but most people, as far as I'm concerned, are mature enough to understand that that's pretty good, not just in politics, that's pretty good percentage in life.
So I'm really struck, and I want to frame this question thoughtfully. You talked a minute ago about on the Republican side, a tent that includes everyone from Charlie Baker to Ted Cruz. And you talked about having the maturity to compromise. One of the other things that we have heard from progressive legislators, including here on our air, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, but nationally we hear this a lot, that there are some existential things on the table right now, and that on the Democrat side, we also have a wide range of views. You've got the delegation really pushing for the minimum wage, but I think arguably Congressman Neal may have shown some hesitation in supporting incendiary or strong or really strong measures to try to get that through. I guess what I'm asking you is, it's a big party on the Democratic side too, and that's even reflected here in the Commonwealth. And the issues are deeply held for people. So how do you bring all of that together in a way that respects the deep needs of where people come from? I'm sorry if that's not a great question. It's just there's so much there.
It's a good question. And first of all, as I said, I think the Democratic Party is actually much broader than the Republican Party. That doesn't mean the Republican Party's narrow. It just means our history has always been to welcome people of different views, as opposed to belittle those people we may not disagree with. We've had trouble with that. And again, we have some Democrats who don't agree with that. But in general, that's been the party's philosophy, number one. Number two, as far as differences of opinion, that has always been the case. Are there some existential issues? There always is. And everybody has to make a decision on their own. What is absolutely essential to them? When I was in Congress, for me, that was human rights, civil rights, those and war and peace. They were absolute. I would have voted my conscience regardless, and I wouldn't have broken that conscience very easily, if at all. Again, you never say never, but I never voted for war that I didn't believe in. But I also wouldn't have voted against war if I thought it was the right thing to do, regardless of what I thought my constituents might want. All that being said, but how, those issues are not every issue. You cannot have, well, you can, but again, it makes you an absolutist. If you say tax policy is absolute, it must be this way or no way. If you say that about every single issue, well, I'm glad you're so comfortable in knowing everything there is to know about everything. Everybody has a few issues like that. Obviously, some of the hot button issues, again, depends who you are. Abortion, immigration, those are hot button issues that people tend to have very strong opinions about. But you cannot have, I just don't see how you can go through life having that depth, that of commitment to every issue that Congress votes on. The COVID relief, again, will there be some people that have an absolute, unequivocal commitment to $15 an hour? I guess there could be. I just don't see it. Democrats in the House didn't have that. I don't think there'll be Democrats in the Senate that will have that. It doesn't mean they're not committed to it. It just means they're not willing to give up everything for that single issue.
All right. So before we let you go, and we do have to shortly, we heard today that Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone isn't going to run for re-election this year. Had you heard that news, and in a sentence or two, just your reaction?
I had heard it, and Joe's done a good job. It's a very tough job. He's lucky to be able to know when to leave. It's a difficult thing to do when you have a job that you like. And I wish him well. The city will do well. It will be a very interesting mayoral election. And I look forward to watching it from a distance, because I will make news here by announcing that I am not running. I know it's a real shock to people, but I've had my
time. There you have it.
There you have it. Breaking news.
There you have it. That is former 10-term Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano, also a former mayor of Somerville, and now the public affairs director for the law firm Foley & Lardner. Congressman, it was great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tiziana. Bye-bye.
Maybe you've seen them. It's a series of bright, colorful billboards with powerful messages of hope in English and Spanish, like one in Roslindale Square. Big, bright letters against a solid background. It ain't easy, but keep going. The unsigned billboards, they've appeared in East Boston, Roslindale, Roxbury, Dorchester. Boston communities hit particularly hard by COVID-19, and they are the work of Gabriel Sosa. Sosa grew up in Miami and is now a visiting lecturer at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design. Artist, teacher, translator, and we spoke with Gabriel Sosa recently about his art.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So there's so much I want to talk about, both in sort of form and message, but let's start with message. It is a simple, hopeful, loving message. How did you land on it and sort of the variations of the messages you're using?
It came kind of from a long process. I was scheduled to have a public art project at some point in the spring or summer of 2020. You know, I had been thinking about the different ways that that could take place, and all of a sudden the pandemic hit. And then I really came upon this idea of what can an artist offer right now? And I thought, well, you know, art can offer a space for critical reflection, it can offer a space for comfort and a space for solidarity. And then the use of the words no es fácil, I mean, growing up in Miami in a Cuban American community, those words are so intelligible across Spanish speaking countries. There's this kind of special flavor of solidarity with that. You can be standing in the long line and someone will look back at you either in Miami or Havana and say, hey, no es fácil. And it's this just way of saying, you know, hey, I got you. That's where that spirit came from. And then it just seemed logical thinking about my bilingualness, my biculturalness, and the large Spanish-speaking population in Boston, that it made sense to offer it both in English and Spanish. This no es fácil, it ain't easy.
Let's talk about this idea of solidarity, which you say this work expresses these messages of hang in there, keep going, express. What does it mean to you, and how do these billboards express a kind of solidarity?
It means that you understand someone, that you are with them, and hopefully that expresses itself in some way to be on the same page and to know where someone is coming from.
Why is that so important right now?
Well, needless to say, the world's
has changed kind of right before our eyes. We're about a year into this pandemic. You know, things that seem sort of unthinkable or almost a little sci-fi for us have become normal. And, you know, not only the pandemic, but also politics in this country, everything that 2020 brought us. And I think just being able to say to someone, look, I know what you're going through, or I can sympathize with you, I think is just one of the most important gestures that anyone can make.
Let's talk about the medium you chose for a minute. We just finished talking about the message. Producer Jamie Bologna and I were both so struck by your choice to use billboards. I think we share a fondness for billboards and the you know, that sort of passing way they communicate with people in their communities, in their daily life. What made you land on billboards?
It came from a place of my being interested in text in the public space. And this, you know, kind of ranged from things like bumper stickers, window signs, street signs painted on asphalt. I thought to myself, well, what's something I can do that shares a message that considers social distancing, that's visible? And then billboards sort of seem like a logical option. And there's also such a rich history of artists that have used billboards as a medium. I mean, there's Felix Gonzalez Torres, there's Barbara Kruger, Dred Scott. So it was really exciting for me to tap into that tradition as well.
Is there some billboard that stands out in your mind, maybe from childhood or from some regular part of your life at some point?
Yeah, actually, just with my students at Mass Art, I was talking about a couple billboards by Felix Gonzalez Torres. There's one that he made, which says, it's just a matter of time. And I think, you know, placing this in different places and just sort of that ambiguity of text, I think is really beautiful and really powerful. And that was something I was intending to strike as well. And just sort of the power that ambiguity can have, the power of ambiguity, interpretation, and allowing people just to take something from the work, whatever that may be. And, you know, as you had mentioned, these billboards are unsigned. I mean, my name isn't on there. And I'm hoping that people have come across them and kind of in this minute of confusion, wondering exactly what they are, have been able to take something valuable from them.
They are unsigned, so people don't necessarily know you're the artist behind them. What do you know about how people have taken them when they've seen them?
I've had different conversations with folks in which, as you have seen, some of these billboards stand alone, and then others are next to other billboards. Sometimes it's next to Geico, or We Buy Ugly Houses, or Chase Bank. Some people have been like, wait, is it an ad? Am I being sold something? I love those moments of like, wait, you know, I don't know exactly like what this is doing, but I agree with this message. It means something to me, which is just what I was going for. But, you know, Tiziana, I've gotten some Instagram messages from strangers and said, hey, look, I came across this and this was really beautiful. It was just what I needed to hear right now. Thanks for doing this in our community. You know, that's something to me that, you know, it's just so heartwarming, almost brings a tear to my eye just to know that these reach somebody.
Did you stand there and watch the first billboard go up? Like, did you watch it unfold on the giant, you know, thing? Or did you just come by one day to see it once it had been up?
It was the latter. My wife and a friend and I drove over there to East Boston. The first one was on the bridge that leads from Chelsea into East Boston. You know, even though all of the billboards were in the city of Boston, you know, Chelsea, of course, is another, you know, Boston area city that has been so affected by the pandemic. So, you know, we just drove over the bridge and it was really exciting to see it, for it to go from my laptop to the real world. You know, I kind of didn't know what the reaction was going to be. As an artist, you sort of never really know how people are going to react to your work. I think especially doing public art, there really isn't much of a metric to know how people are reacting to it. But then shortly thereafter, I started hearing from folks.
I've learned over the years that one of the things particular about putting up a billboard is essentially it stays there until the company that owns the billboard has something else to put in its place. So it seems like your art is sort of randomly transient, or temporal maybe is the better word. Do you see it that way? And is that a pro or a con to you in this particular case?
Yes, it is sort of randomly temporal, as you said. Each of those billboards have been up for at least a month. And I say at least again, because this, as you mentioned, this issue of the contract, right? So, you know, people would say, well, how long is it up? And I'd say, well, I can't really tell you. You know, I know it's been up for the next date. And so, you know, some of them have been up for, you know, just over a month, and some of them have been up for months, for 4 months, 5 months. I appreciate just that sense of temporality. There's something serendipitous about it, right? Where you can just be kind of walking down the street and encounter this message, and it'll hopefully resonate with you in some way. And then you go there the next day and it's gone. And it's like, wait a second, what was that? Is something else coming in its place? Is it part of some storyline? But you look up and then, you know, you might just see Geico and you're like, what was that? So I love that element of chance that the temporality brings.
I've talked to a number of artists, art administrators, art institutions over the last year. And each has something specific about their art form to say about how art supports resilience and builds community. What's your thought on that?
You know, again, coming back to this idea of what can art offer and what's your audience? A lot of the time, I think there's sort of this white cubeness attached with that question of, you know, what's your audience? What's your community going to be? How can you share work? How can you be resilient and offer solidarity? And I'm really, you know, kind of drawn to work that has some kind of intimacy toward it. You know, I think a lot of times we think, oh, well, you know, an audience is going to be someone that's walking through a gallery and looking at paintings on a wall, something like that. But it's like, well, that doesn't have to be the case, right? You can have an audience of one, or you can make something for an entire city. So an institution, you know, can offer something on a large scale. But I think, you know, as artists, we can offer something on a really small scale, too.
Okay, so fast forward 2 years. Let's say you had a chance to do a follow-on installation. What do you think or hope your message would be 2 years from now?
It's hard to say because I created this project kind of specifically for this moment. So as to say what's going to happen 2 years from now, I'm not sure. I have no idea what a follow-up might look like, but I do know that if there is a follow-up, it will respond to whatever's happening 2 years from now.
And that is Gabriel Souza, a visiting lecturer at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design. His series of billboards are part of Now and There's Public Art Accelerator Program. Gabriel, thanks.
Thank you, Tiziana.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Hitesh Hathi is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.